Coming up next on Lutheran Radio UK,
The Lutheran Inquisitor, examining pressing issues and their ramifications for the Church today.
Hello and welcome to this edition of The Lutheran Inquisitor. I'm your host, John Ehlers, pastor of Christ Lutheran Church in Orpington, Kent. We'd like to invite you along to any of our services. We meet for divine service every Sunday morning at 10:30. And we'd like to wish all of our listeners a very happy and Christ-filled Christmas. May the joy of the newborn King be yours this Christmas season. We'd like to also thank you for your prayerful and your financial support of Lutheran Radio, for that's what keeps us going. Today, we're very excited to welcome to the program Dr. Joel Heumann. Joel is the interim preceptor of our theological college, Westfield House, in Cambridge. Joel's going to be speaking to us today on some of our most favorite Christmas carols. Dr. Heumann, welcome to Lutheran Radio. And the first Christmas carol that we want to discuss today is O Little Town of Bethlehem. Its author was Philip Brooks. Can you tell us a little bit about Philip Brooks and maybe the history of this hymn?
He was an American clergyman. He was actually an Episcopal clergyman, was a bishop in Massachusetts in the 19th century. You know, quite a famous bishop and theologian from his day. And he actually wrote this hymn for a Sunday school Christmas festival service in the 19th century. And wasn't actually a popular carol at first. It was kind of slow to gain popularity, but since then it's become, you know, a favorite, not just in the U.S., but of course in England. I mean, here in Cambridge, it's used traditionally as one of the carols in the Nine Lessons and Carols at King's College, so it certainly gets a lot of airplay over on this side of the pond, as it were. And The background for the hymn is really interesting, because Brooks apparently was inspired to write the lyrics to this carol when he himself visited the Holy Land in 1865, and it was in the month of December leading up to Christmas. And on Christmas Eve, he traveled by horseback from Jerusalem to Bethlehem. You almost get the sense that he's experiencing sort of this travel to Bethlehem on the night of Christmas and thinking about how the Holy Family might have done that or experienced that, or the sights and sounds 1900 years earlier. He wrote this 100 years ago. And so the background is quite interesting. First sung in a Sunday school pageant, like I said, and then from there was printed in leaflet form for sale in New England and in the East Coast of the U.S., and just sort of gradually gained in popularity.
Terrific. And you mentioned that he originally was inspired by his trip to Bethlehem. I was recently there, and Bethlehem now is quite a large, bustling, very interesting city. But the hymn begins, O little town of Bethlehem. In the biblical times when Jesus was born, was it a little town? And what was the biblical background for Bethlehem?
Well, the biblical background to Bethlehem, was probably a bit of a backwater town compared to Jerusalem, but has historically was the ancestral homeland of David, King David, the first monarch of the United Kingdoms of Israel and Judah, formed by the 12 tribes. And so, as the Gospels record, according to the time of the census that we know about in Gospel of Luke, this was the occasion, I guess, for the for Mary and Joseph to return to Bethlehem because of their Davidic ancestry.
And also there is the prophetic prediction in Micah chapter 5. Again, I'm assuming that serves as part of the background for this text for the hymn.
Certainly, yeah. Matthew, you know, re-records that and puts that to Christological use. And you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah, for from you shall come a ruler who will shepherd my people, Israel. And, of course, that is sort of a twofold prophecy, isn't it? It's looking back to David, who was sort of the first shepherd king of Israel, but it's looking forward to the return of a Davidic king, a messianic king of the line of David, who will come to restore the fortunes of Israel.
And from the time of Micah, that was the Davidic line was coming to an end, if it hadn't already. And so you'd gone several hundred years without a Davidic king on the throne.
Yeah, so the hymn really picks up the idea of this Bethlehem being the town in which Jesus as the Messiah comes to birth, and makes the link between this prophecy and the events of the Christmas story.
And does Brooks hit that on the last line of the first verse where it says, "The hopes and fears of all the years are met in thee tonight"?
I think so, yeah, definitely. And he knits that very well into the story of the Christmas story. What's interesting, too, I think, about the is how he is a masterpiece of poetry, because he not only sort of links the past with the occasion of the birth of Jesus, but goes on to further draw sort of parallels to us today, how he talks about Jesus being born of Mary back then in the little town of Jerusalem. So also God imparts to human parts the blessings of his heaven. That sort of this birth of Christ becomes then a trope or a metaphor for Christ coming into the hearts of people to transform them, you know, with the love of God.
Yeah, because the world was a world of sin back then, and it still is today. And for meek souls who will receive him still, the dear Christ enters in.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
And then I think if we look at the fourth verse, there are some wonderful allusions here. Cast out our sin and enter in, be born in us today. And again, I think that links it very nicely to what you were talking about.
In its original form, there were five stanzas even. There's one that's left out, which I quite like. It goes, "We're children pure and happy," and you can see the sort of background to this being this Sunday school festival service, because it's making the link to sort of the children who would be gathered and singing it. "We're children pure and happy, pray to the blessed child, where misery cries out to thee, son of the undefiled, where charity stands watching and faith holds wide the door, the dark night wakes, the glory breaks, and Christmas comes once more." And that's where it's really made explicit, that idea of, by the grace of God and through faith, Christ enters into people's hearts, transforms the dark night into the glory of dawn, and this is like a Christmas happening in each and every child where this occasion happens.
So again, a bit of the Isaianic prophecy there, where those who sat in darkness have seen a great light.
That particular stanza doesn't make its way into a lot of, it's not really in circulation so much anymore, certainly not in our hymnal, unfortunately.
And then at the conclusion of verse 4 as well, I think there's a lovely Old Testament allusion again. "Oh, come to us, abide with us, our Lord Emmanuel." And again, going back to Isaiah 7, could you comment on, again, a bit of the significance of the Emmanuel passage and its meaning for us today?
Well, the Emmanuel passage was taken as a piece of typological prophecy, the account of, "And lo, a young maiden," or "a virgin will conceive." This was sort of picked up in New Testament theology as being sort of a typological prophecy of the coming Messiah Christ. God with us is the meaning of Emmanuel. And, you know, this is a common refrain through the New Testament of Christ being the locus where God meets with man, or God comes to man. So we tend to think of the hymn primarily sort of mining the Micah passage and Matthew's use of that in the second chapter. But there are all sorts of other Old Testament allusions in the hymn as well.
While the theology in the hymn, I think, is wonderful and incarnational, but the real controversy is which tune do you sing it to, Joel?
Of course, that's an immense controversy, you see. Here in the ELCE, we have quite an international contingent. So some people are used to singing this to the tune of, I suppose it's the original tune, of St. Louis. The tune is called. It's the way that you most often hear the carol in the U.S., which is the origin of the carol. But here in the United Kingdom, and sometimes in the U.S., particularly in Episcopal churches, it's sung to an English hymn tune called Forest Green. I prefer Forest Green. I'm in the Forest Green camp myself, put it that way. That was an adaptation done by Ray Vaughan Williams from an English folk ballad called The Plowboy's Dream. And I think it's a wonderful tune. But of course, you know, whenever you've got a classic carol like this sung to two different tunes, you're going to have people on the other side.
Dr. Heumann, thank you for those insights into the great Christmas carol, "O Little Town of Bethlehem." But now let's move on to "Joy to the World." Again, Joel, can you tell us a little bit about the background of this wonderful hymn written by Isaac Watts?
Interestingly here, this is very much taken to be a Christmas carol or a Christmas hymn in the United States. I think if you say Joy to the World, most people think in North America, this is probably the most published Christmas hymn in North America, certainly one of the most recorded ones, and, you know, just even in popular culture. One of my personal favorites being the 1965 version by Diana Ross and the Supremes, you know. But, of course, what's ironic about this is it was never written as a Christmas hymn as such. It was written by Isaac Watts, very famous hymn writer in England. And at the time of Isaac Watts in England, even the Church of England itself, hymn writing was a very controversial exercise. It was a much more Calvinist environment in England. And in Calvin and Reformed theologies, hymn writing was really sort of a not the done thing. It was really only the authorized things to be sung in churches were psalms. But of course there are ways to get around these legalistic approaches, and one of them was to make metrical paraphrases of the psalms. That is to say, you take the psalm text, but rewrite it in poetry, with a meter, with rhyme, so you're paraphrasing the psalm, but it still sort of falls under the rubric of being the psalm, and so is can be sung in churches. And Joy to the World was, in fact, a paraphrase of one of the psalms. In those days, when you published a hymn book, it was basically free paraphrases of the Psalter. So you were getting poetic renditions of the psalm. Sometimes the hymn writer would be quite liberal in their paraphrase and very loose. So that wasn't so much as a translation, but the psalm is almost inspiring the text. And I think Joy to the World is one of these. It is a free paraphrase based on Psalm 98 in our English Bible. Psalm 98 being, sing to the Lord a new song, so he has done marvelous things. His right hand and his holy arm have worked salvation for him. So on and so forth. And that's what Joy to the World is. It's a paraphrase of that psalm. Also interestingly, I mentioned that it wasn't originally intended as a Christmas hymn. As a matter of fact, Isaac Watts' original vision for this was not Christ coming in the incarnation or in the Christmas story, but rather Christ's return at the end of time was what he envisioned. But it came later to be associated more with Christmas and Christ's first coming in the birth of Jesus. It's quite interesting how this developed just through sort of traditional reuse into a Christmas hymn, which was not what it was originally written to be.
Well, as we look at the text of this hymn, in the first line, it says, Joy to the world, the Lord is come. Now, yeah. Am I just dreaming, or is that is something that's significant?
Well, it's early modern English, but it is significant as well. It's perfect tense of to be. I suppose in contemporary English we would say the Lord has come, but it doesn't really communicate that same abiding perfect tense sense that the Lord is come does in early modern English. The idea that it's not that just that he had come and left, but he came and he remains with us. Again, that theme of Emmanuel, God with us. It's interesting that when Isaac Watts is composing the hymn, he really has end times in mind. I don't want to really speak or assume his theology or something, but perhaps he's seeing as the impending return of the Savior as being that time when the Lord will then come and abide with us. And I think it's actually a good theological corrective to think of this more in a Christmas sense. That in Christ's incarnation, this is really the ushering in of the eschaton, that God comes to us in the baby Jesus and remains with us even after his death, resurrection, and ascension, in the preaching of the word, in the sacraments, in the ministry of the church, even throughout all ages.
And again, it's sort of that whole Advent theme of the coming of Christ, coming with his incarnation, coming to us through his word and sacraments, and coming at the end. But I can see, as you mentioned, this was originally seen as a hymn preparing us for the second coming. But if you look later on in this first line, let every heart prepare him room. And again, I think that the Christmas season, you know, there's no room in the inn, resonates well there.
It really is an Advent hymn, isn't it? And Christ's first Advent, second Advent, these things are sort of telescoped into the Advent season, even liturgically as we observe it. And so this hymn really does speak to both of those realities.
And I'm also struck by the fact that he involves creation in the hymn of praise. Again, you mentioned a paraphrase of the Psalms, but, you know, rocks, fields, and plains, and floods, and mountains, and the whole thing. Again, bringing in this whole aspect of creation joining in the praise of God.
That's drawing directly from Psalm 98, isn't it? That the psalmist is invoking all of the earth to engage in this psalm. Make music to the Lord. Let the sea resound and everything in it, the world and everything in it. Let the rivers clap their hands, the mountains sing for joy. And you've got this image of the whole creation sort of engaging in this jubilant worship of God. Now, what's interesting, and as I mentioned before, it is a psalm paraphrase, but people like Isaac Watts and others, when they were paraphrasing, this was really an occasion for them to almost use the psalm as inspiration to some free creation. It really does become a hymn. He's taken this idea of the world rejoicing and crying out in psalm, and in what is the often taken as an optional verse, we don't often hear this, the third verse sung. What's depicted is the sort of reverse of the fall of creation in the Genesis narrative, where the expulsion of in the story of the expulsion of Adam and Eve from the garden, and the curse laid upon the man that he will have to toil the ground and work until the day he dies, and that the earth will no longer yield up its fruit but thorns and thistles. You see, this curse of the earth. This imagery in Psalm 98 is taken as a sort of eschatological reversal of the primeval curse of creation. No more let sins and sorrows grow, nor thorns infest the ground. He comes to make his blessings flow far as the curse is found. And so that image of the earth rejoicing is an earth being liberated from this curse.
And Jesus, as the second Adam, does that. And that's what this third verse is pointing to, isn't it?
Yes.
And I knew you'd bring us back to Genesis. You always do.
Yes.
Okay, let's move on to our third hymn, which is Lo, How a Rose Ever Blooming. Now, I remember this as Behold, a Branch is Growing from my early days, and being an old Lutheran, I, you know, you can't accept change very well here.
Yeah.
But again,
all sorts of translations.
There are. Can you tell us a little bit about the history of this hymn, whatever its name is?
Well, its origins go back already to the 15th century, although I think its earliest appearance in a hymn book is 1599. And so we're not certain of the original authorship of it, but it's definitely a medieval carol, a medieval Christmas carol. Obviously takes its cue. There is a Lo, How a Rose Ever is Growing, or Ever Blooming, or whatever translation. A bloom of finest grace, the prophets had foretold it. A branch of Jesse's race would bear one perfect flower here in the cold of winter in the darkest midnight hour. This is direct occasion from this in the Old Testament, and for the development of this hymn is Isaiah 11:1, where you have that messianic passage, there shall come forth a shoot from the stump of Jesse, and a branch from his roots shall bear fruit, and the Spirit of the Lord shall rest upon him. That's where the hymn takes its cue. Originally 23 stanzas, so most people want to thank their hymn book editors for reducing that somewhat, because as lovely as it is, 23 stanzas is a lot to sing in these days.
I must confess it is one of my favorite hymns. But again, can you explain to us a bit about this branch of David that is growing from the stump of Jesse? What does that mean?
That's an incredibly interesting question from the historical perspective of this hymn, because it's been through a whole lot of translations from the German original. And as a matter of fact, in the original German translation, this a rose has sprung up from a tender root. As the old one sang to us, its lineage from Jesse, it has brought forth a floweret in the middle of the cold winter half night. Now, originally, we have two stanzas of the hymn that clearly indicate that in its medieval origins, this was a hymn that was not addressed to Christ, but was addressed to the Virgin Mary. Stanza 2 of the hymn identifies the rose or the shoot, as prophesied in 11:1, as Mary. A shoot will come up from the stump of Jesse, and then she bears a branch who is Christ. And so we see the real medieval Catholic Marian focus of the hymn. It really does break that in that medieval interpretation of the text, though, really does sort of break the parallelism of the Hebrew that you do find in Isaiah 11:1. And in Hebrew poetry, this is a common feature that of strict parallelism, parallelism of ideas, according to which the shoot that comes forth from the stump is the shoot is the branch, and the stump is the root. You see, taking that verse in strict parallel fashion. So our more modern translations have altered the text somewhat to indicate that the rose is that branch, the rose is that shoot from the stump or from the root of Jesse. And of course this doesn't nearly as easily avail itself of the medieval Marian interpretation.
So we are correct then in saying that Jesus is that root, or I mean that is that branch that is coming from the stump of Jesse.
Well, that would be the reformational Christological typological interpretation of it, yeah. And the idea here, of course, being going back to the intention of the text itself, which is to see a messianic figure to come to restore the Davidic monarchy. In the original context of Isaiah 11:1, of course, you have Jerusalem besieged, you have the kingdom of Israel threatened, besieged by Assyrian invasion and war, and this is looking forward to a restoration, a period of restoration, a restoration of the Davidic line.
So I suppose, to put it bluntly, Jesse's family ran into a buzzsaw, and now it's coming back to life again.
It's coming back to life in this bud that's coming from the stump of Jesse.
And as we continue in the hymn, we go to the middle of verse 3, and again we see the very common refrain of the darkness which is everywhere. Again, the sort of Isaianic statement of those who are in darkness have seen a great light, and also we think of the Gospel of John. The darkness cannot overcome that great light, and the wonderful Advent themes there as well. And we see the incarnational, true man, yet very God. These are themes we run into regularly in Christmas hymns. Would you say this hymn is particularly good at drawing those out?
Yeah, I think it is. I often think of how the Gospel of John in its first chapter really brings the contrast of light coming into the dark world, and speaking of it in these theological tropes, and that's really underlying some of the imagery here in the third stanza.
Well, thank you, Dr. Heumann, for some insights on these three wonderful Christmas carols, and hopefully as we sing them over the Christmas season, again, we can gain some further insight into the wonder and the mystery of the incarnation of Christ. Thank you again for your time. Would you like to tell us a little bit about Westfield House and what the Theological College of the ELCE actually does?
Well, I suppose in a nutshell, we teach theology. We do that in a Lutheran context. We do that in a Cambridge context, so we really, it's a great place to be and a great place to study theology, and people can come here. We're an affiliate teaching college that provides the London International Bachelor of Divinity in Theology, and people can pursue that bachelor degree here, but we also offer a Westfield diploma for people who are studying for ministry in the church, whether it's pastoral ministry or diaconal ministry. And that's what we do here. I myself teach Hebrew texts and Hebrew Bible and Old Testament, dabble in some other things, and it's a great place to be.
Now, if anybody would like to find out more information about Westfield House or contact you, how can they go about doing that?
Well, probably our website at westfieldhouse.org.uk actually is undergoing a redesign, which we're going to launch hopefully in the next couple of weeks in the new year, so maybe hold off a couple of weeks to see our brand spanking new one. But everything there you want to know about Westfield House should be on the website.
Again, Dr. Joel Heumann, thank you very much for your time. We wish you, your family, and everyone at Westfield House a very blessed and Christ-filled Christmas. And God bless you in all the work and the teaching that you do.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Lutheran Inquisitor with Pastor John Ehlers. If you have any questions or comments about the issues raised in this program, send an email to info@lutheranradio.co.uk. The podcast of this show is available from our website. Check our program online and stay tuned.